Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by one other of our regular Thinking Fellows, Dr. Adam Francisco, who's here with me today. And we're actually recording at Concordia University Irvine, and we have a guest with us today. I've been doing a couple of interview episodes the last couple of weeks, and we have Dr. CJ Armstrong on the show. Listeners may recognize the name. I complained about him on the show and the Latin course that I suffered through. No, I really enjoyed it. But the last two semesters before I graduated last spring,
So
which is a great time. And so we brought you on the show to talk about kind of classical education, the languages, you know, those things that you kind of specialize in here at Concordia. You do a lot, though. You teach languages and history and theology.
I tend to do it all, and I've had my feet, one foot in each world of theology and also of humanities and the ancient world classical studies, that sort of thing, for a long, long time. From the time that I went on to seminary, I was doing the master's work that they offer at Washington University in St. Louis, which is real close to the Concordia Seminary. And several of my colleagues there while I was at St. Louis, there in the late 90s, were doing the exact same thing, because there's a natural marriage between the study of the ancient Mediterranean and what's going on in the ancient Near East and what's going on in the context of the development of the Old Testament literature, the New Testament literature. And, gosh, it's just way too much fun to read Latin poetry to give that up for a little while.
It's
a wonderful thing. As you know, Adam, you've been reading Virgil's Aeneid with our history students for the last 7 to 10 years here doing our Q&A.
Have been.
Yeah. My students say that all the time. Yeah, we read, Dr. Armstrong. We read. Yeah, there's nothing better, in my opinion, than the study of the classical world, especially in the original languages, and especially if you're reading Roman poetry. And let's get more fine-tuned than that, the poetry of Publius Ovidius Naso. I love that guy. Yeah, if you read Ovid, there's no going back. It's wonderful.
And you're no mean poet yourself.
Oh, yeah.
He can throw together a limerick like nobody's
business. Yeah, he did it in
class. There
once
was
all the
time. A teacher named Adam.
Oh, gosh.
I'm not going to go forward from there.
probably best not to. Well, I've been wanting to do an episode on education for a long time. We've briefly touched on it here and there throughout other episodes, kind of the emphasis on being classically educated or thinking about philosophy alongside theology. And we do, you know, Adam covers historical topics on the show too. And I, you know, I thought this would be a great fit for you, because while I was in class with you, or even just around campus, you are an apologist for this kind of this education, taking your education seriously, and especially absorbing kind of what the liberal arts has to offer, no matter what major you're in here at the university.
Or what profession you're in.
That's right.
Sure. The station you find yourself in. I can't go as dramatic as to say things like the entire institution of education, public, private, whatever, in North America or the United States or California is absolutely broken or anything like that. I have way too much respect for all my colleagues in higher ed, and especially my friends here at Concordia University, whether they're teaching students going forward in bachelor's work for public education or Lutheran education or graduate work to go that direction. There's a lot of good work that happens with teachers, both in public and private schools. But the fact remains that we've been doing education, this business of education, for a whole lot longer than the last 100 years. And one of the things that I try to encourage students in, if they find themselves on the student side of the lectern, or if they are thinking themselves about teaching, is that at some point everybody's going to teach, and teaching doesn't have as much to do with the skills of pedagogy as much as it has to do with content and love for that content, and that's whatever the subject may be. And I always encourage my students to pay real close attention to the first things, the foundations, the liberal arts, because that's where we've been doing good things with education from before we even talked about them as liberal arts, right? In some ways, I regret that you weren't here to put down on a recording the words of our colleague in Mequon, in Concordia, Wisconsin. Susan Mobley was just here. She's chair of the Department of History. at MechOne, okay. And she was delivering some words for a couple of groups of our students over this past week on classical education and how virtue works with the liberal arts, and how that's been a perennial thing from the time of Isocrates and Aristotle to Cicero to Quintilian through the Christian West, the Middle Ages, and how that results in the sorts of things that we hold dear at a small Lutheran liberal arts university like ours. That's the thing that I attempt to push for our students all the time, especially for those who might think about being an educator. Being a teacher at a public school, you know, K through 12, being paid by a district, being paid by the state, is not the only route for being an educator, and nor is being at a private school that might be church-related, mm-hmm. may or may not be sectarian, a charter school, a private school. There's homeschooling. I know a lot of friends of mine who are so sick to death of what they see as problems in education, not only, for example, public schools in the areas that they happen to live in, but also Lutheran schools. They say, oh, Lutheran schools are going downhill because they're just copying what the,
public schools are doing. Whatever, right?
I hear that argument a lot. I want to be sympathetic, but at the same time, I know that there's some wonderful things that are going on in both public schools and in private schools. Our Lutheran education is has a fine history. But we also care about classical education, and some schools more than others. Lutheran classical education and classical education, this is the buzzword, right, for a movement of people that want to say all of what we've done for the last century in American education has gotten away from those foundations, the foundations of virtue that are attendant with a training in the liberal arts. When we have a grounding in a Christian morality, and match that with the freedom to teach grammar and rhetoric and logic and the rest of what comes out of the humanistic renaissance, history and the greatest things that have ever been written down, have ever been said, as opposed to the agenda that the state might want to push down the throat of anybody writing mm-hmm. a curriculum or something like this. They say, well, let's try out this classical school thing. And that's right up my alley because I'm a classicist. I'm somebody who deals with the ancient languages, the ancient texts, the ancient world. That's where I find myself being asked to talk about classical education. I wouldn't consider myself a classical educator. I'm didn't grow up in a classical school. I grew up in public schools. Went to University of Arizona after going to public mm-hmm. schools in Arizona. But I care about the classics. And when we're thinking about classical education, the classics, and here I'm talking about the ancient Mediterranean in particular. I'm not talking about ancient Mesopotamia or India or things like mm-hmm. that. There's a lot of good stuff to study there too. But in the West, our heritage is especially couched in the politics, the history, the learning, the understanding of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. And to understand those people, we should learn as a foundation the ancient language and the ancient texts. That's why the first of the liberal arts is grammar.
Mm-hmm. For the Christian, in the early days of Christianity, mm-hmm. you know, a debate of sort breaks out. Starts perhaps with Clement of Alexandria, mm-hmm. Tertullian, and what does reason have to do with philosophy?
Sure.
Or what does faith have to do with philosophy? Or
yeah, the faith, reason, the knowledge,
you know,
faith.
That sort of thing. But then you in the 4th century, so after mm-hmm. after Constantine and the, if you will, the Christianization of the Mediterranean world.
Sure.
There's a question asked of what value are the classics for the Christian? And, you know, from the text like Basil the Great.
Yeah, Basil of Caesarea has that wonderful text on the proper use of Greek literature.
Yeah.
I think
important. What is it for the Christian? Why should to put it real simply, why mm-hmm. should a Christian who has all they need in the New Testament, so maybe in Romans.
God said it. God said it. I believe it. That settles it.
Why should they read a pagan like Aristotle or Plutarch or whoever?
Well, there's certainly people that say they shouldn't. You know, if you're sufficient with the Old Testament, New Testament literature, that's all I need for salvation. I can turn on my heart and turn off my brain, and that settles everything, right? Basil's a great example of this, though, and I love that you bring this up, because all of the sophomores at Concordia University Irvine have to engage that very brief text. It's Basil of Caesarea, writing between 361, 363 AD, somewhere around there, the time of Julian the Apostate. Writes this treatise for the young men under his tutelage at a time when Christians were possibly being told not to be teachers anymore, and then they were told that they could be teachers. It was a time of competing orthodoxies and the beginning of a legitimized Christianity. Basil says, his argument is, we still need to read the Greek classics. You need to read your Hesiod. You need to read your Plato. You need to read your Aristotle. Because in this, you find how to read. You discover how to read. It's a mirror for the truth. One of his great analogies in that text is that the leaves of the tree are the things that shade the fruit, the glorious fruit being the salvation that's understood by the holy word of God. But if it doesn't have leaves, that fruit's going to burn. If it doesn't have the shade, you're not going to understand anything. It's going to destroy you. The analogy is that if you want to read the Bible, if you want to read the word of truth, you need to know how to read first.
Yeah.
You need to know what the virtues are that Aristotle talks about, that Hesiod talks about, that you can even find from Homer. Basil of Caesarea doesn't say that you should read it all and take it all in as nutritious for you. There's a lot of lies that the poets tell, too. There's a lot of polytheism that runs the show if you're going to read Homeric epic work, right? He says you don't have to believe that kind of stuff, but understand the virtues that come out of those. That's our foundation. If you don't know how to read those things, then the Bible is going to be a closed book for you, too. Everybody has access to texts. Not many people are literate. Maybe 5 to 10%, being very generous, of anybody in a community is literate at the time. But people have access to these texts. So when he says when you need to learn how to read, well, at least you need to know how to hear and listen. And he's got that thesis that he's actually teaching. You need to learn. He actually is talking to students who know how to read. These are the books, these are the texts that you're going to find virtue in.
Yeah, it's like a question almost of epistemology, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's a universal foundation to learn, picking up knowledge, mm-hmm. being able to understand mm-hmm. what you're going about. And you have tools that help you then when you are going through the biblical text. Or
that's right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What else do you think about as far as the Christianization is concerned? Do you think, Adam, there's something unique about a Christian education as opposed to what we would call a liberal education, education that's right for a free man? Do those things have to stay distinct?
I don't think so. I mean, I think you fast forward centuries mm-hmm. to the Renaissance. A lot of people who have heard of the Renaissance will at least say, oh, that's Ad Fontes. It's that move in mm-hmm. Europe and starting the 14th century where with like Francesco Petrarch, 14th century, in a way says, I want to go back. Everybody's quoted Cicero, right? Mm-hmm. And these quotes from Cicero are just passed on, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. But nobody's really understood him in his context, the context of the overall writing and then the historical context. And that is going back Ad Fontes to the source, but also the Renaissance is, in a way, an attempt by these European figures, especially when you get into the 16th century, to go back Ad Fontes to the source of Western civilization, to learn. So you got Christian civilization, but let's learn from more these successful civilizations in the past and see what else we can learn in terms of examples of virtue. Or you get to Machiavelli, who nobody likes, but in his work, The Prince, he says, as he's writing to the Medici family, if you want to know how to successfully rule as a prince of a republic, mm-hmm. why don't we go back to successful republics in the past?
Right.
Because all these medieval authors, he says, have envisioned what a republic might look like.
Right, the ideal.
The world of ideas. Mm-hmm. But there's actually some real stuff in the past that we could profit from.
Yeah.
So, while people argue whether the Renaissance led Europe out of Christianity or not, I don't think you can make that case, but it certainly kind of reoriented
mm-hmm.
Christian society as well as the curriculum that's studied in the universities.
Well, the humanism in that area is essential to the Lutheran Reformation and the Reformations from that too. You don't get a lot of what Luther and Melanchthon come up with exegetically without this desire to go back to these sources.
Absolutely.
And especially talking about Melanchthon, also going back to the classics and to those authors and implementing that into a European education system too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dr. Mobley, once again, from Concordia Mequon, laid that out in very plain, very patent ways yesterday during convocation, talking about classical education and its roots in the Lutheran Reformation. Melanchthon was a powerhouse for this. And
Something like 600 gymnasium and schools open throughout Europe according to his outline.
Right. And her thesis, which is I think is not arguable at all, that's entirely defensible, is that Luther is the first real impetus for a full-on public education as opposed to keeping things in the hands of the elite. No, a good society needs to have citizens that are well-educated.
And that even included girls. girls.
That's revolutionary. It sounds like Paul in 1 Timothy. Let a woman learn. I know people want to glom on to let a woman learn in silence. Certainly. But we're not talking about a thoroughgoing misogyny here. We're talking about a
freedom.
Revolution. Yeah. Right. Let a woman learn. That's extraordinary. Let the girls learn in the 16th century.
And even understanding that kind of goes back to looking at broader context, history, right? Understanding the areas in which you're reading in, having not just one form of knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Not just the ability to read those scriptures, but to understand what's going on around.
That's right. Wouldn't that be amazing if people respected history more? if people did, they would find themselves being much more humble before the text, because it takes a while to learn a language. It takes a while to translate the Bible into German if you're a Luther or others who had done so. It takes a while to learn dead, highly technical, ancient Mediterranean languages. But that's where the source is. That's where the spring is. That's where the font is. Mm-hmm. That call for ad fontes. That's why I think students need that. That's the foundation of liberal arts, the grammar part. Even if you didn't like it, Caleb, us, e, o, o, e, ordem, e, so, sees. Well, we need that kind of stuff in our life, not just to organize the brain, but to give ourselves a fighting chance to keep civilization from tipping over the precipice of disaster, as well as just giving us a little bit of fun to read some Roman poetry from time to time.
I always tell people that was, in many ways, tackling the hurdle of Greek and Latin and Hebrew here, were probably one of the most beneficial things because it really did reorient how I read things, my ability to go and say, that sounds funny. Mm-hmm. Can I go find the original text and work through it?
Yeah.
Even skills like memorization honed through there that make, give you a system to go and memorize other parts of texts that may have been a challenge before. Yeah. Something that I had foolishly, now looking back at it, pushed off till later.
I don't think you're ever too old to learn.
Yeah, but I was always afraid of it.
Uh-huh.
And then when I finally got to it, I realized it was something I could do. I could I could, with the proper time put in, do well, and something that benefited all my other studies throughout.
I'm glad to hear that you were afraid of it, because I think, as Yoda said, you should be, right? It's not an easy thing. It's daunting. And it's what students that are engaged in higher learning ought to push themselves to do, because it keeps you humble. It develops an intellectual virtue. It develops the intellectual virtue of humility before the text, But before we read into anything, before we place our own opinions, our own philosophies on top of a reading, we need to get right back down to ink and paper and say, what does it say? And how do I know that I know what it says? And that's what, well, it does keep, and it ought to keep, and in most cases, among the people that I like to hang out with, it does keep them intellectually humble before the test.
Yeah, it's hard to put a philosophy in there if you're struggling getting the basic sentence put together on paper.
Right. Yeah, but
and then the
no
content,
substitute for that.
The content, history, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Here's, because we're heading towards a break. I want to cap it off with it because I've been looking for a time to quote this.
You have a good internal timer there, Adam.
So the content you find in these historical texts, Jose Ortega Gasset mm-hmm. wrote this. He's a I think he was mostly a Latin American historian, but he wrote a work called Toward a Philosophy of History. And here's what he says about history. Man's real treasure is his history, and it's the treasure of his mistakes, piled up stone by stone through thousands of years. Breaking the continuity with the past, wanting to begin again, to ignore the past, the text, and so on, is a lowering of man and a plagiarism of the orangutan. So, the classics, liberal arts, that's the way to keep civilization going, in a way. That's his point here. And it's a way, as we teach here,
right.
That's how to churn out, if you will, to use kind of marketing terms, wise, honorable, and cultivated citizens. So, let's take a break now.
Yeah, that's great. All right. All right, welcome to our break. Today we're going to talk about a book that is a translation that Dr. Armstrong just completed and published recently, I think in the last month, right?
Yeah.
The name of this book is Lutheranism versus Calvinism, The Classic Debate at the Colloquy of Montbelliard, 1586.
Yeah.
And so that's a really interesting time. But what is the story behind this? It's a project you've been working on, and I think people are familiar with Dr. Mallinson too, right?
I asked him to edit it for me, and he was gracious enough to do so. And I asked him to edit the text for me because of his expertise in Theodore Beza, the student of John Calvin, the slugger on the team of the Reformed, that is the Calvinists in the 16th century. He's published in Beza and whatnot. And this is a primary text. Talk about going back to the fonts, ad fontes. In 1586, a debate transpired for about a week between Theodore Beza on the Reformed side and Jacob Andrea, one of the crafters of the Formula of Concord, along with Martin Chemnitz for Lutherans who are familiar with the Confessions, the Book of Concord. Andrea is a pretty important element in that later Reformation history, 40 years after Martin Luther's death and Melanchthon's gone and whatnot. What's happening with the Lutherans? Well, Chemnitz and Andrea formulate the formula in order to establish some peace, some unity among the Lutheran states, the explication of and representation of Lutheran theology. Well, in 1586, the little corner of what we might call the meeting place between modern-day Germany and Switzerland and France. There's a county there called Montbéliard, which now today has a wonderful Peugeot manufacturing center. Mm. It's got a lot of Catholics
in the Alsace,
there.
In Alsace, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But it used to be Lutheran. And in fact, in 1586, it certainly was. The Württembergers were the counts of that county, and they were Lutheran. But they were surrounded by Huguenot French Calvinists, as well as Catholics, Papists, and so there were pressures. There were pressures for those who were exiles from the French Wars of Religion, who needed to flee from where they had been exiled, and they wanted the sacrament. So how do we get together and feel all right? Well, the Lutherans were unwilling to capitulate to what we call the Variata edition of the Augsburg Confession, where wasn't a big change.
But he Melanchthon compromises on the supper.
There you go. Yeah, and I'm sympathetic with Philip in the reasons why he felt like he needed to do such
things.
That's
good to hear. We spend a lot of time on this show defending kind of some in American Lutheranism what's kind of been some maybe unfair treatment.
And through the rest of the 16th century as well, and of course in the 20th century too. People say Philip's just of the devil and this sort of thing. Well, there's some good reasons, but I think those distinctives are even more important to maintain. And so did Andrea and the formulators of the formula of Concord. And this is why ultimately the Duke of Württemberg asks Jakob Andrea to have a conversation, have a conference with Theodor Beza, and it becomes a sort of celebrity death match between the most important theologians of the Lutheran camp and the Reformed camp. And the transcript of that colloquy in its first edition was compiled by Jakob Andrea. So it's a very Lutheran document. It's his perspective of what happened, what transpired, his transcript. It's interesting. It's about 600 pages worth of printed Latin, which CPH asked me, Ben Mays, the editor at that time of that area of books at CPH, asked me, hey, you want to translate this stuff? And I said, I'm not much of a translator. I'm more of a reader of Latin. I don't want to necessarily be a translator. But I was convinced to, and I think there's some really good things about that. To make things accessible to an audience that might not otherwise read it, I think that's a pretty good service that you can do to the church and to this generation. I don't think it's ever going to be a bestseller, right? Who wants to read 600? Well, who wants to read 600 pages? But at this there's one other piece of that if you know what the Colloquy Mont Belliard is, you're probably well versed enough in Reformation theology and history that you probably already know enough Latin to get into the text in the original language. I don't think it's necessarily a pretty translation. I tried to keep it pretty wooden and with the Latin word order, so you can kind of go back and forth between the text and see what's going on. But I'm proud of it, and I'm proud that CPH really wanted to make that text accessible for a crowd. I've given a couple of talks on it that I've titled, What Has Wittenberg to Do with Geneva? And then I heard that my dear professor Robert Kolb is working on a text called "What Does Wittenberg Have to Do with Geneva?" Right now, he was kind enough to take a look at the manuscript, as well as many other scholars as well. So I'm looking forward to hearing any kind of response to the text that just got published this year. Especially if it's helpful for getting a good understanding of the confessional age, the later 16th century, the Reformed and Lutheran dialogue that was happening then and a little later, and maybe even the Reformed and Lutheran dialogue that happens today. If there's one thing I learned about Reformed Lutheran dialogue as I was doing this translation work, it's that people in the 16th century, they were really jerks when they talked to each other. Mm-hmm. And they were jerks because they wanted to defend, not because they wanted to be jerks, maybe, but because they really wanted to defend the truth. And they knew that their read of the Scripture was the true read of Scripture. And so there was something very evangelical about that. I'm certain from Beza's side, and I'm certain also from Jakob Andrea's side.
So you can buy that at cph.org, which I'll post a direct link to that there. I also believe I've seen it available on Amazon, but CPH doesn't always put a giant stock on there when it's a research-oriented book or things like that. So I'll go make sure and see if it's still on there, still available on Amazon. So that listeners, if you're interested, can go take a look at this. We have a lot of Calvinists who listen to the show. Wonderful. And are always asking about, as you said, the dialogue between Lutheranism and Calvinism. Mm-hmm. And this would be a way to get back kind of at the roots of that dialogue, maybe get past some of the baggage of today's kind of hang-ups of you know, what we think are the central parts of the debate between us and go actually and see what did some of these founding figures in Lutheran thought and Calvinist thought think were actually the points of conflict.
Yeah, yeah. And if you have Latin, if you are able to work in that language, the edition that I was working from is available as a Google book, too. But you'd have to know how to read Latin.
Is it in a CR?
It's online. If you look up a colloquii with a J at the end, Mopo Gartensis, and this sort of thing, so you can find it. But you might have to do a little bit of searching. Yeah,
be one person out of a billion who might do that.
But hey.
Where two or three Latinists are in a room.
We have research students who listen to the show in Norway and Germany and things like that, so they might they might get a kick out of that. We'll see. But as you're saying, this work is you kind of going back to the sources and trying to make sources accessible for today's audience, and that kind of ties into the general theme of this episode. Mm-hmm. And so we spent the first half of the show kind of talking about this form of education kind of goes back to Western roots, especially those in Greek and Rome, and how this matters to the church and kind of plays out. But in a kind of a direct sense, how does it matter to – why does it matter to me in my everyday life, especially people who don't plan on having careers in academia, right, where perhaps this isn't part of their daily conversation. You know, people like maybe my brother who, works with his hands, does construction work and things like that. What are the benefits overall in his life of having this?
I think we're allowed to have conversations about all kinds of things, but informed conversations are that much better, right? The unexamined life's not worth living. We need to know ourselves, and we need to know some arts to keep us free. Like if freedom itself and the comportment of being a free woman or a free man has any kind of significance, then this kind of education is not just to check the box off and move to the next level or advance in my career. I got to get to the next step. But it's an education that is supposed to make you good, period. It's supposed to make you good as a person. It's supposed to give you those things that give you the learning necessary for a lifetime, to be able to think broadly and deeply, to be able to communicate broadly and deeply. They're goods unto themselves, but they're goods that are intended to be used in service of the neighbor. And that's why this great conversation that we have goes as far back as it does, because it's not just a good conversation to have. It's a conversation about the good. It's a conversation about goodness, about why to learn certain things and why to love certain things, why to hate certain things, why to avoid other things as well. It's a question of not just being good for me so that I can know a whole lot of stuff, but so that I can be of service in a good society. I think that's where I would start that conversation. But what do you think, Adam?
Yes.
See how I threw you under the bus.
No, I'm always amazed at how, right now I'm reading a book called Warrior Politics, and the subtitle is Why Leadership Demands a Pagan Ethos.
Mm.
And it's Robert Kaplan, a journalist, who's arguing that there's, in light of today's international concerns with third worldism and terrorism and so on and so forth, he says, we've got much to learn from the ancients in this, because they dealt with this stuff all the time.
Sure.
So, and then I think of the now governor of Missouri, Eric Greitens, wrote a book called The Heart and the Fist. He Oxford DPhil and then went off, served in one of the SEAL teams, and he argues in that book that for being beneficial in the world, it's great to have a big heart and want to serve, but you also have to have a little muscle behind it. But in that book, it's really interesting. He's quoting all these classical authors and how this is sort of a thing in the Western tradition. So you mentioned, Caleb mentioned his brother as a construction worker. How might this stuff serve him? And you added, or you said, just to be part of the conversation, but it is this, as you so eloquently put it, and for a while, it's about the conversation with our neighbor about what is the good.
Yeah,
which I'll say, you know, he He's so right now what he does is blacksmithing, and when he's out at this, he went out into a school where he learned how to, you know, forge steel and the like. And one of the students that he met out there that he's really good friends with now, they disagree on a lot of points of their worldview, and the conversations they have, you know, would be dead ends apart from some greater knowledge, right? Yeah. You just start shouting your kind of emotions at each other if you don't have, you know, anything universal to talk about, somewhere where you can go go back to what are these experiences.
It probably should not come as a surprise, or it shouldn't be all that shocking, but the issues the ethical issues, political issues, this is common stuff. It's perennial. And so rather than just reinventing the wheel, why not go see how people dealt with those issues in the past? You'll make a much more informed decision if you do that. So, you know, it's not just about the good in an abstract sense.
That's
talked about it's about the real practical, pragmatic good.
That's right.
So you find yourself, when I went through university, I didn't read the classics in any sort of disciplined way. It was read them
every once in a while
because it was
get
fun,
or
like,
sure,
oh, yeah, why is Luther quoting Cicero here, or whatever. But then all of a sudden this guy, C.J. Armstrong, I'm teaching with him. We started full-time the same year.
Yeah.
And he, as we put together this curriculum, he's forcing me to read this stuff that Homer, Hesiod, Thucydides, and I was amazed at just how, I mean, Homer's Iliad, I'd read it as a kid, I know, in grade school. I start reading it for a class here, and I'm just reading it just to be able to teach it. But then all of a sudden I find myself sucked into the story, and because of the virtues you see exhibited, the interpersonal stuff going on is timeless.
And you grow into these sorts of things, too. That's a different book when you're 36 than when you're 18.
Oh, yeah, sure, right? Sure.
But it is timeless. It
I
grows
wish I was
you.
36.
I look the same. I used to look like I was 50 when I was 36, and now that I'm 43, I still look like I'm 50, I think I'm getting better.
You're still a handsome man, though.
Well, We're kind of hitting time, but
and hitting the bottom of the conversation,
right,
obviously.
But
and I'm very sick, so that's my excuse. The meds made me do it.
But thank you for joining us. I really did. This was a great conversation. I really liked where you hit just a couple minutes ago about talking about this. Really, there's a pursuit of freedom here, the preservation of freedom, and that's a lot of where we get our intersection with Christianity and the Reformation. Right, there was a freedom from the bondage of a church that had failed the people, that had stopped truly reading, you know, giving them the scriptures, proclaiming Christ to them. And, you know, part of this education, as Christians, part of our heritage in this education is kind of that recovery of the scriptures of Christ through kind of this this great thought. And so thank you for listening to the show. If you like this episode, you'll probably like a lot of other episodes too. This is so you can go ahead and subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. You can catch the show every week on our website. And once again, thank you, Dr. Armstrong, for joining us. It was great to have you on, and we'll probably have you on in the future if we can make it happen.
My pleasure. I'll look forward to the next time.
All right. Thank you.